The Late Debate with Katie Hannan on RTE Radio 1.
And now we turn to tonight's late diversion, and we turn to Limerick, where just over 100 years ago, the city went on strike and formed a Soviet. Although it only lasted 2 weeks, it didn't stop them from printing their own money, controlling food prices and publishing newspapers. I've been speaking to Liam Cahill, historian and author of Forgotten Revolution, the Limerick Soviet of 1919. And he began by describing what was going on in the world at the time.
Well, in a word, what was going on in the world at that time was turmoil. Turmoil in Europe. There had been for several years the Great War, 1914-18, the Bolshevik revolutions in Russia and other countries, and in the defeated countries in World War I, such as Germany, Austria and Hungary and Bavaria, there were worker revolutions and red flags flying and Soviets and takeovers. The same was true in Britain as well. Hundreds of thousands of demobbed soldiers were coming home, either to find themselves unemployed, or if they were fortunate enough to get a job, to find that their wages were being slashed. And so you see an outbreak of big general strikes in cities in Britain and Ireland, such as, for example, Glasgow and indeed in Belfast as well. There had been turmoil in Ireland. It was a decade of turmoil, all the way from the rising of 1916, the general election of 1918, the conscription crisis, the setting up of the first Dáil, and the first shots of the War of Independence in the early part of 1919.
What was Limerick like in 1919?
The turmoil that was going on, the revolutionary events that were happening, both internationally and nationally, they were reflected in Limerick as well. There was a spectacular growth in trade union membership in Limerick City and County from about 1918 onwards. That was spearheaded by the Irish Transport and General Workers Union, which was a new type of union, not only in Ireland, but anywhere in Western Europe, in that it believed in the concept of the sympathetic strike, that if one section of the membership was on strike, the other sections of the membership would come out in support of them until the strike had been won. The idea of the sympathetic strike. And of course, that growth in the Irish Volunteers, the Irish Republican Brotherhood and Sinn Féin that we saw in the years, say, 1917-18, that happened in Limerick as well. There was a huge upsurge in both nationalist sentiment and in militant trade union sentiment as well. And of course, there was the catalyst of IRA hunger strikes and agitation by prisoners in Limerick prison for better conditions and for recognition as political prisoners.
Who were the key players in all of this?
The most important one, in a way, is the man whose death caused the Limerick Soviet. He was a man called Robert Byrne, a young man, a senior member of the Irish Volunteers and of the Irish Republican Brotherhood, but was also very deeply involved in the trade union movement. He was chairperson of the Post Office Workers Union, and he was a delegate to Limerick Council of Trade Unions. And what happened was that on the 6th of April 1919, he was in a hospital in Limerick, suffering from the effects of his hunger strike, and his colleagues decided that they would spring him from the hospital. And in the attempt to do that, there was a gun battle, and Robert Byrne died later that night.
Batty Stack was the raider who shot the RIC guard in the attempt to rescue Bobby Byrne.
Then Bobby didn't go to bed and ran down along the ward. Constable Bryan pulled his revolver, so I'd time I do something about it. So I fired at O'Brien, took his gun, then the lads went off.
Did you kill O'Brien?
O'Brien died.
The inquest found that he had been shot by a police bullet. This was followed by a massive funeral in which about 10,000 members of the Irish Volunteers and Cumann na mBan from all over the Midwest marched behind his coffin, where there were shots fired over his coffin. And in response to the huge demonstrations which took place, the British government panicked. They believed that what was happening in Limerick was a further escalation of what had already begun a couple of months previously, and also at Sulahead Beg in County Tipperary, where the first shots of the War of Independence had been fired. So they decided to declare Limerick a special military area, and military passes were imposed. Another key person, I would say, was a man called John Cronin. He was a carpenter by trade, and he became the chairperson, the leader of the general strike, which became known as the Limerick Soviet.
And of course, by a complete fluke, it got massive international attention.
There were many international journalists and film crews for the newsreels in the cinemas in Limerick, because it was a time when there was a great flurry of competition and activity to find who would be the first person who would successfully fly the Atlantic from east to west. And I suppose, being good reporters, they saw one story had flopped and there under their noses was another one. 14,000 workers and their representatives had taken control of the city of Limerick. They controlled the shops, the prices, distribution of food, transport. They had their own newspaper. They even had their own currency. And it struck many of these reporters that there was great similarity with what was happening in Limerick, with what had already happened in Moscow and in Petrograd and in other cities in Europe. And so they said, this is a Soviet, and they called it the Limerick Soviet. And John Cronin, whom I mentioned, he was asked by an American reporter, is this a Soviet? And he said, yes, if you want to call it a Soviet, it is a Soviet.
Why did you say there that they had even, you say, their own currency, they were running shops, they were bringing food to people? Like, why did the merchant people of Limerick fall into line with this?
First of all, there was a lot of emotion in the city because of the treatment by the British authorities and the prison authorities of the IRA prisoners in Limerick jail. They were men, as it happened, all of them, who were in jail because of their political beliefs, and they should have been accorded privileges which are normally given to political prisoners. And then, of course, the measures which were announced by the British government were extremely repressive. The city was surrounded by troops and barbed wire. They put barricades on the two bridges across the river at the time, and you were required, if you wanted to go to and from your work, you had to go to the police, get a permit and show that to the troops on the bridges 3 or 4 times a day. And that meant that thousands of working people were cut off from their jobs or from their houses. The first people who said they weren't going to put up with it were 600 women employed in the condensed milk company. And then their strike, which started on a Friday, by Monday had escalated. There were militant people obviously involved in the leadership and the organisation of the strike. But there were many moderate people who might not necessarily have been supporters of the Irish Volunteers at the time in Limerick, or who would not have supported an armed struggle, as we call it, who did support action against British militarism at the time because it was seen as so excessive and so harsh and interfered greatly just with ordinary life in Limerick.
But ultimately, it was short-lived. What brought its downfall?
When the pressure comes on and hard decisions have to be made, they fall apart. So that local coalition of militants and moderates, they recognised that they needed to escalate the Limerick general strike and the Limerick Soviet to a national general strike. That was the only way that they could gain victory. But when they sought to escalate it nationally, the two elements of the coalition at national level not only dropped out, but actively opposed it. So, for example, Limerick was discussed 3 times by the cabinet of the First Dáil. And despite the fact that it had strong support locally from the IRA and the IRB, the cabinet decided that they would not support an escalation of Limerick. And it's interesting to see those who supported an escalation of Limerick were Michael Collins and General Richard Mulcahy, the IRB members of the cabinet. And on the other side, you find Eamon de Valera, Cathal Brua and Austin Stack all saying, no, the first thing we need to do is get freedom for Ireland, and then we can deal with social questions afterwards. And it's interesting, I think, Katie, that that's more or less the same lineup as the split ultimately on the treaty as well. And on the trade union side, the Irish Labour Party and Trade Union Congress were scared, witless really, of taking on the British in a national confrontation. They felt they didn't have the organisation to take them on. And not only that, there was a total opposition to any escalation of Limerick by the trade union movement, by the head unions in Ireland whose headquarters were in Britain, and equally by unions who represented Protestant workers in Belfast and in the northeast.
Too much too soon, as they say. What kind of a legacy did it leave, though?
It left a legacy. Some of the militant trade unionists that were involved in it, such as John Dowling of the Irish Transport and General Workers Union, they went on, and from 1919 right through to 1923, particularly in the province of Munster, they organised a very militant campaign of Soviets taking over creameries, bakeries, factories, mills, with slogans like, "We make bread, not profit. We make butter, not profit." That went on for about 4 years. There were strikes throughout the province of Munster, seizures of farms and so on. But in the end of the day, the momentum fell out of it, because really what happened was that the Free State began to prevail. And as they got stronger, and as the Republicans receded in the Civil War, law and order began to be reimposed across the countryside, including Ireland. So you find the Soviets being wound up and ended by the Free State forces.
And that was historian and writer Liam Cahill telling an extraordinary story of an extraordinary time, and telling it really well. John Dowling, as a proud Limerick man, is this stuff you learnt about on your mother's knee?
Not quite on my mother's knee. There's an interesting connection there, I have to say. My poor mother, I used to read a thing called The Limerick Socialist. I used to have to hide it from her. It was produced by the late, great Jim Kemmy. And Jim Kemmy, to me, I heard him speak on this issue very many times, going way back as early as 1969. And some months before his death, I heard him speak in 1997. He died in 1998 from memory. But he was the one. There were many others, but he and others produced a marvellous publication called the Old Limerick Journal and local history. And certainly there's very, very wide acknowledgement and folk memory of this, down to the point where Limerick finally produced a third bridge over the River Shannon, and there was a movement then to name it after some of the people associated with the Limerick Soviet.
Yeah, it was extraordinary time. Mary, were you familiar with it?
No, not at all. And I suppose when I got the heads up today that we were going to hear about this tonight, looked up Liam Cahill's book of, you know, the Forgotten Revolution. What a fascinating time, and to have the preparation that went into it to get that level of collaboration. But I suppose what we see was a pattern of excessive force that special military area created by the British at the time, causing people who would have not been sympathetic to this type of revolution coming alongside. And it was a repeat almost of the pattern of events of
1916.
Fascinating.
Yeah, you've studied this.
Yeah, I was a history student myself, and I suppose when I remember that period in time, one of the slogans that comes to mind, kind of making a comparison between then and now, is De Valera's idea that Labour must wait. And in many ways, that was a great lost opportunity of the Limerick Soviet, the democratic programme that followed in 1919, and equating the working class struggle, the labour struggle, and equating that with the nationalist struggle, and the idea that all of those, the Limerick Soviet and those that aspire for kind of a greater Ireland as we emerged into a kind of a national Ireland outside of British control, they were asked to put that on hold. And of course Kevin O'Higgins then went on to call much of what happened in the Limerick Soviet and the democratic programme as largely poetry. And I think there's a comparison there in terms of some of the conversation we were having earlier in terms of people not willing to come off the put payment to go back into workplace, because 350 is very different. Is we can't allow kind of the labour movement to be separate from the lessons we've learned from the pandemic. In terms of, if we've seen anything during this particular pandemic, it's the workers in supermarkets and shops. They've been truly essential. And if to have conversations around living wage, why do we separate them from conversations around the National Health Service? All of these things need to happen in unison. Labour cannot longer wait, because what happened in the Limerick Soviet, what happened in those labour questions when we set them aside, meant that we went into a two-party conservative right system for the next 80 years. There's another opportunity now emerging from the pandemic to equate nationalism and labourism at the same time.
Janna Hart, are you worried about this new opportunity?
No, I mean, I don't think that we could afford to leave key workers in the rearview mirror. And there's some really good stuff written about that. I was curious about Liam Cahill's description of the context. Just one thing that struck me, which proved Ida Milne's point when she wrote about the Spanish flu, was that it has been lost in our memory and that that had an impact in how we approached this pandemic. He never mentioned the Spanish flu in the historical context of that time. And the country was just beginning to kind of emerge really, really slowly from that. But my final word on it, I think, you know, when you look back, we've built, you know, an unfinished but a half decent republic. There's unfinished work. There's an awful lot of work to do, left to do. And I was always curious. I used to follow Jim Kemmy's career. That a bit like Waterford, there always seemed to be this enclave of socialism in Limerick, and I wondered what its roots were. And similarly in Waterford, in the city as well, there was that kind of enclave. But I share Gary's point very much on key workers, those who kept the country going, the shelves stacked, and somehow we've just moved on really quickly from that. And I think in the final conversation we have about COVID, when we look at the impact of it, if we ever look at it in the rearview mirror, we have to reassess how we treat those workers, because the country simply wouldn't have functioned without them.
OK, I've got to take my last break.
Email latedebate@rte.ie.